loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Mumia Abu-Jamal has been in prison in Pennsylvania since 1981. He was on death row until 2011 when his sentence was converted to life without parole. Mumia and his supporters have always maintained his innocence, and he was in court today in Philadelphia. He's asking a judge there to vacate his previous appeals attempts on the basis of judicial bias so that he can appeal the case again. Next, the attorney for a right-wing organization that sues for conservative causes has filed a lawsuit against Arizona's teachers, contending that their strike is illegal and seeking to force them back to work. But teachers remained on the picket line today, the third day of the strike. They're dissatisfied with a modest pay raise proposed by Governor Ducey. Then we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. Today he focuses on a trip to the opening of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, a museum and memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, that honors the memory of lynching victims and asks localities to publicly acknowledge that they occurred. And then Admiral Harry Harris has been nominated to be Donald Trump's next ambassador to South Korea, an outrageous idea for a man who presided over the torture at the Guantanamo military base. We'll look into his record. And finally, Randy Credico was invited to the White House Correspondents' Dinner over the weekend as a guest of Yahoo News. But the Washington swells didn't like Randy's message of freedom for Julian Assange, and they unceremoniously threw him out of the event. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Philadelphia. Mumia Abu-Jamal has been in prison in Pennsylvania since 1981 after being accused and convicted of killing a policeman. He was on death row until 2011 when his sentence was converted to life without parole. Mumia and his supporters have always maintained his innocence, and he was in court today, county court, in Philadelphia. He's asking that court to vacate his previous appeals attempts on the basis of judicial bias so that he can appeal his case again. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. And he's the author of Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Dave, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dave, this is a very important hearing today because, as you noted before we went on the air, it's at the county level, the lowest level court in the state of Pennsylvania. So explain to our listeners why that's important.
His conviction was at the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia. So that is the basic criminal court level in the state. And then it went through an appeals process at that level and then on up through the state court system to the state Supreme Court before going to the federal appeals level where his death penalty was overturned. But his conviction stands. And what this hearing is looking at is a issue which, if it went his way, which it should, would bring his appeals all the way back down to the ground level at the county court level. He'd get a new, probably a new post-conviction relief act hearing to allow him to present new evidence even, which is important because there has been new evidence. And then on up through all the stages of the state process, which would also open his, and this would be on his conviction. And then it could go beyond that to the federal court level if it went, you know, if it started at the state level. So it kind of resets the, it would reset the clock on all his appeals.
And then that would allow him to appeal, if he were to lose again, it would allow him to appeal all the way through the state Supreme Court again. Is that right?
That's right. And probably, depending on whether constitutional issues were raised, which I'm sure they would be, he'd get into the federal courts again.
That's one of the big frustrations that Mumia has, and many people have. And Mumia, as we talked about, was on death row for so long, almost put to death several times.
That's right.
Just narrowly avoiding that. There's this international movement demanding freedom for Mumia, but what Mumia is actually seeking is a retrial. He wants, right? I mean, Dave, he wants to be able to have his day in court because the first time around was plagued by systematic racism and discrimination. Of course, it's a murder of a police officer is involved. Mumia was a well-known leader of the Black Panther Party in Philadelphia. The Philadelphia police have been targeting the Black Panther Party for a long time, since they were founded there. The judge at the time of the sentencing made explicitly racist comments about Mumia. Obviously, the deck was stacked against Mumia.
Yeah, this was a classic kangaroo court. I mean, it was just, in my book, I documented how he got screwed at every level, at every stage of the appeals process, and at the original trial. And it was a total mockery of any sense of a fair trial or appeal.
Yeah, and talk about the influence of the Fraternal Order of Police. The police officer who was killed, Daniel Faulkner, his wife, was she there again? I know she was speaking out to the media beforehand.
This was amazing. It gave a really good evidence of how this works. At this hearing, there were a lot of supporters of Abu Jamal who came to the courtroom, and, you know, it's so many that people couldn't get in and were, you know, waiting out in the hall. And what you saw was there were a whole bunch of, just an enormous number of cops who weren't on duty, you know, guarding things. They were coming in and going into the courtroom in full uniform, with their guns and everything, and their badges prominently displayed, and other ones waiting outside. And when cops would come out, the sheriff who was guarding the door and blocking entry would let more cops in, but wouldn't let, you know, other members of the citizenry in. So what she was doing was maintaining a ratio of cops in ordinary people in the audience. And so you could see what was going on was to intimidate the judge and say, you know, the cops were saying, we're watching you. And I was wondering, you know, these cops all in uniform were either told to come in uniform so that they'd make a show of blue in the court benches, or they were on duty on the taxpayer's dime coming in and sitting there to intimidate the judge.
You know, I'd be interested, too, to know how much money police officers gave to the campaign of the district attorney or the Fraternal Order of Police.
The FOP is one of the biggest contributors to judicial races in the state.
That has to be the case in Philadelphia. And I wonder, too, I don't know as much about this case as so many other people, but I wonder, too, why Mumia was not granted a change in venue. It just seems that he couldn't possibly have gotten a fair trial in Philadelphia.
Well, this goes back to the whole issue of how bad Abu Jamal's legal representation was right from the start. You know, and some, you know, in fairness, some of that was his own fault, because he picked somebody as his lawyer who had a great record of fighting police brutality, Tony Jackson, but no death penalty experience. And so he really botched the jury selection. He botched a lot of stuff. And then Mumia took over because he realized Jackson was a disaster, also a cocaine addict, as I documented, but who later was debarred. But he kind of got stuck with himself as the attorney. And while he's a brilliant guy, he's not a brilliant lawyer. And so there were a lot of mistakes made. And obviously that would have been a major thing to do, to just get the thing the hell out of Philadelphia, where, you know, you had the whole white establishment and the police department and the Justice Department lined up against him.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the former district attorney, too, Ronald Castile. We were talking off the air before we started this segment about his, the appearance of conflict of interest. But maybe it's not going to be so easy to win this thing. Can you explain that?
No, it won't be easy. But, you know, there's my colleague Lynn Washington has coined the term the Mumia exception to all court precedent, because repeatedly there have been a precedent set of people having their cases overturned, their convictions overturned in the state of Pennsylvania. And then when it turns out that Mumia has exactly the same situation and it is appealed on the basis of a new court precedent, the courts don't apply the precedent to Jamal. And then subsequently another person will come up on appeal, and they'll reapply the precedent. So there's this, you know, little moment in time when don't apply the precedent, and it's always to Abu Jamal. You know, he's like a radioactive case for the white legal establishment, and they just this is the first time a judge who happens to be black at the common pleas court level has stood up for, you know, looking at applying a precedent, because we had this case where a guy had his conviction overturned because Castile had been involved in his prosecution, and then Castile went on to become a Supreme Court justice for the state and then Chief Justice. And when the case came up to the Supreme Court level on appeal, Castile didn't recuse himself and he voted against this guy. Now, the same thing sort of applies to Jamal, not quite the same because Castile was not a prosecutor in his case directly, but he was the DA. He took over from Rendell, who was the DA before he became mayor and then governor. So Castile was the DA overseeing the DAs, the assistant DAs who were fighting vigorously to defeat all of Jamal's appeals at the state level.
Yeah.
And later at the federal level. So he clearly was, you know, this was probably the high-profile case in Philadelphia while Castile was DA.
And I hate to cut you off, but we're out of time, but it can't end here. This is something that we have to watch that is going to be not just in the news, but it's going to be important on the issue of appeals.
And people can read Dave Lindarf's book, Killing Time, An Investigation into the Death Row Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal by Dave Lindarf, our guest. I was just looking at Amazon, Dave. I don't know if there are other places that you would suggest for people who want to read your book.
Oh, you can get it directly from Common Courage Press, too.
Okay, very good.
Terrific. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindarf, an investigative reporter, columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The attorney for a right-wing organization that sues for conservative causes has filed a lawsuit against Arizona teachers contending that their strike is illegal and seeking to force them back to work. But teachers remained on the picket line today, the third day of the strike. They're dissatisfied with a modest pay raise proposed by Governor Ducey. We're joined from Washington by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. He was recently in Arizona to cover the strikes. Dan, welcome.
Good to be with you guys.
So, Dan, tell us what the mood is like on the street. This Red for Ed seems to be an honest-to-goodness movement, and it looks like the teachers have popular support in Arizona. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. There's broad support, in the public in Arizona. It really transcends the partisan politics. It's not really a liberal or conservative thing. There's broad agreement that public education needs to be funded by the public, by taxes. The mood on the ground, I was there, I was at the Red for Ed walkout on Thursday and Friday, the first days where they walked out to the Arizona State Capitol. And it was really, it was powerful scene. It's the largest walkout in Arizona's history, the first statewide. It was a lot of very motivated teachers, mostly teachers, who have really seen public education under attack, under a bipartisan attack for decades. And they've basically, they're unable to pay their bills. Most of them have to work second jobs or rely, on their partners if they have one, or their family members to help them get by. And they kind of, had it up to their heads, with the state legislature and the government and the governor Doug Ducey's attacks on public education, and not only on their salaries but also on the school funding, which is lacking very much. There were teachers who they were very celebratory. They're finally ready to be out and make their voices heard after years of basically having to just grin and bear it. And that, you know, some were saying that we don't have to be martyrs anymore, you know, just to, we don't have to take it on the chin just to get, you know, their students what they need. So they're really hopeful and they're very committed. And, I don't think they're going to go back to the classrooms without their demands being met.
What do you make of this lawsuit, this conservative lawsuit trying to force them back to work? Is there anything to that?
So the state superintendent, Diane Douglas, warned early last week that a strike is illegal, although they're not technically striking. They're still in a walkout phase, and they may decide to go on strike if their demands aren't met. There is no legal, it is not illegal for the teachers to walk out. All there is a 1971 Arizona Attorney General opinion that says a walkout or strike is illegal,
right.
But there's no actual legal precedent. So I don't know. I'm not a legal expert, but I don't think there's any real grounds for this kind of lawsuit. And it's just, I think, what appears to be a hollow gesture to intimidate the teachers and also, you know, try to make them appear to the public as if they're being selfish, which has been one of the kind of right-wing media's tactics to weaken public support. But it's really failing, in my opinion.
That's a tried and tested tactic by the rich and the politicians who represent the rich, that when working folks go on strike, when they try to have a decent wage, and when that wage, having a decent wage, means you could feed your family, suddenly workers are greedy. Like, it's this whole Alice in Wonderland sort of rendition of reality. I'm looking at a USA Today story, Dan, from a couple days ago. And one of the headlines is, I've never not had a part-time job.
Yeah.
Teacher strike continues in Arizona. I want to read the first couple sentences to you. The president of the Arizona Education Association said the state teachers will walk out for a third consecutive time Monday, that's today, following 2 days of rallies last week demanding respect and financial support for their classrooms. Quote, in order to keep my job teaching, I've had to downsize my home so I could still afford to teach, said Irene Vasquez, 56 years old, a math teacher in the Phoenix suburb of Peoria. I've never not had a part-time job. I mean, and here we have politicians and bureaucrats and some parts of the media calling these teachers greedy and selfish. I mean, it's not just bizarre, it's so disgusting. Go ahead, Dan.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at just talk about some of the figures that we see in Arizona. Arizona teachers are the lowest paid in the country. They make about $42,000 annually. I mean, Arizona is a relatively, you know, low cost of living state, but there's just no way to get by on that. And so one of the things one of their demands is a 20% pay raise. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but because of the cuts to the salaries over the years, that would only restore their salaries to the levels they were prior to the Great Recession of 2008. Teachers make 11% less than they did in 2001. So, I mean, this is just, you know, huge cuts over the years. But you know, if you talk to the teachers, it's not only about their salaries. It's also about getting funding for the schools. And for some, that's actually, you know, they say it's more important because they want the students to be successful even more than themselves. Arizona is 47th in the country in expenditures per student. That's $4,000 less than a national average. And meanwhile, Arizona, the state government spends $20,000 more annually on each prison inmate than it does per student.
Oh, sure.
And so we really see what the priorities of the government are in Arizona and the state legislature. And there have been massive tax cuts for corporations. This is not just under Doug Ducey, who is up for re-election this year. You know, I think this will make a major impact on his chances. This is, you know, going back to Jan Brewer, and even before her, where, you know, right now I think there are 400. These corporations are getting $400 million in tax cuts per year on the eve of the walkout on Wednesday evening. Governor Ducey signed a tax cut for a coal corporation, and he's, you know, he says, well, I don't know what these teachers are talking about, but you know, here's a tax cut for a coal corporation. So it really shows where the priorities are. It's basically Governor Ducey, the Republican-led state legislature, and its corporate backers versus the public in Arizona.
You know, it's not just Arizona, even though it's true there. I'm looking, Dan, at a L.A. Times story from a couple of days ago. At $75,560, housing a prisoner in California now costs more than a year at Harvard. That's America's priorities. Let's build prisons and let's incarcerate people, working class and poor people, because that, more or less, that's who prison's for. And yet, every time teachers fight, teachers who can't make ends meet because without a second job, and who frankly also pay a lot of money out of their own pocket to make sure the students have supplies. Let's call them greedy. But here we know what the problem is. I think the teachers may be part of the solution, though. I mean, when I saw that sea of red, all the teachers and their supporters wearing red, it sounded like more than 50,000 on Friday. You were there, Dan. I mean, how did it feel?
Well, I grew up in Arizona. I've covered Trump rallies there. I've seen the Russiagate rallies, this kind of thing. And this was by far bigger than any other, you know, protest or anything I've seen. It was absolutely a sea of red that stretched for blocks and blocks.
Oh, yeah.
There was a march Thursday morning that started from Chase Field, where the Diamondbacks, the baseball team, play, that marched, must have been about a mile and a half, to the Arizona State Capitol. And it was completely full. I was up on top of a parking garage, and it was just red as far as you can see. So it was really, really inspiring to see, you know, that kind of movement come out in, you know, what is not typically a really active population politically in that way.
So in the next, we only have about a minute and a half. In the next few days, or even the next week or so, how do you see this playing out? Is there going to be any give on the part of the government?
At this point, it's hard to say. I mean, last week, the legislature took a recess on the first day. There was basically ignoring the demands of the walkout. There was talk about an emergency session, and then that didn't happen. There are some of the teacher leaders there. What they have proposed is what they're calling the Invest in Education Act. It's a ballot initiative which would fund public education with higher income taxes on people who earn more than $250,000. So have basically to have the wealthy contribute towards public education. And there's really, it seems like there's no room for the governor to slip out of this one. So if the governor and the Republican-led legislature refuse to budge, I mean, this walkout will continue. I really have no doubt.
Yeah, it's going to go on and on. That was the voice of Dan Cohen. Dan joined us from Washington, where he's a journalist and a filmmaker, and he was recently in Arizona to cover the teacher strikes. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. Bill, welcome back.
Good to be here. Nice to hear your voice.
Same here. Thank you. Bill, you made a trip to Alabama this past week to visit the National Memorial for Peace and Justice and to visit the Legacy Museum in Montgomery. This is a new museum. It's a new memorial, and it's very important. Can you tell us about that trip?
Yes, we went down on April 26th and 27th, which was the official unveiling of this new National Memorial for Peace and Justice. And combined with the Legacy Museum, these are two projects of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, led by Brian Stevenson, a really extraordinary attorney and advocate. And EJI has for years been focused on advancing an honest reckoning with the legacy of slavery. And what they argue is that slavery wasn't exactly ended. It more evolved into Jim Crow segregation, into redlining, into a lynching campaign of terror, and into eventually mass incarceration. So they see this long shadow of slavery. And what they've done is created two extraordinary institutions. And I have to, before I even mention more about it, urge everyone to go down and visit and take the children in particular, because this is an attempt to look unblinkingly at the terrible parts of our history in order to reconcile. And you can't have reconciliation without the truth. So this is a really wonderful thing. And I'll describe it to you if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Well, the National Memorial itself sits on a hilltop overlooking the capital of Alabama, where, incidentally, we often talk about education. The state legislature twice in the last 5 years has reaffirmed that segregated schools are legal in Alabama. Now, that's hard for people to believe because aren't we 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education? But in Alabama, segregation is legal. And it's an extraordinary thing to be on this hilltop looking down on the heart of Alabama politics. But it also happens that this is the founding capital of the Confederacy. So you're looking from the top of this hill down at exactly the problem it's noting. But what's up there on this hilltop? They've done the hard work of memorializing over 4,000 people murdered in the terror campaigns that followed the abolition of slavery and the defeat of Black Reconstruction. And to walk into it, you walk up this grassy path, and then you enter this square, and what you're confronted with is these tall, rectangular, metal weathered boxes, and they're about 6 feet tall, and you walk in, and you're suddenly surrounded. It feels like you're walking through a national cemetery. These are like tombstones. And each rectangle has the name of a county, and underneath it, the names of every human being who was killed, lynched, in the 5 decades after the Civil War, or more than that, really, 6 decades after the Civil War. Every name is accounted for. And so you suddenly are overwhelmed with the vastness of this crime. And as you walk, it seems that these rectangles are suddenly rising up in the air. Actually, the floor is descending. But eventually, instead of being surrounded by tombstones, you're looking up at what look like bodies hanging from a tree. But each one, as I say, is the marker of a particular county where at least someone, but often many, many people, were murdered.
Bill Ayers is our guest. We speak with Bill every Monday in a segment called Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers. Bill, when you think about it, this experience, the experience that you're talking about, just think of every school kid in America came to Montgomery and had the same tour that you had. I mean, from the point of view of education, in terms of the education that really matters, especially for younger people, to have a kind of visceral experience. It has a lot of content, but it's there. You feel it. You're right there, and you experience the different stages of the memorial. You know, that's what should happen in America. I mean, we need to, like, do a crash course on all of these kind of things, but especially this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the problem with not facing history is that while we can't unmake history, we don't have to relive it if we face it. But facing it can be very, very painful. And I must say, the effect of being at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice is devastating. But the beautiful thing is that there's a recognition that there can't really be racial reconciliation without reckoning with the truth. And the truth of history can't be unmade. So that's what you see here. You face history. It can be agonizing. It can be horrifying. But there's an unambiguous statement of the fact that it happened. And the cost of not remembering is excruciating as well. And that's why your point about students visiting there is so important, because knowing our history doesn't mean wallowing in guilt. It can mean, and it very much, you get the feeling in this memorial, that it should mean that we can be citizens of a country that doesn't yet exist, that we can reconcile our terrible past, but we can't reconcile it if we don't look at it. And looking at it is tough but necessary. And as I said earlier, you know, slavery begets Jim Crow, begets mass incarceration. And you can see, for example, lynching's fingerprints all over the serial killings of Black youth in America today. It's that same assumption that you're guilty unless proven innocent, or that Black kids are somehow up to no good, or they're somehow less than human. And that legacy lives on until we eradicate it by shining sunlight on it. And that's what this memorial does.
Bill, you know, one thing that I think our audience will be surprised to learn, unless they've studied this, is that although the North won the Civil War and slavery was officially abolished, but after the period of Reconstruction, which basically, you know, formally ended around 1876, when Northern troops were removed following the election of Rutherford Hayes, America turned against the verdict of the Civil War. And in our schools, public schools, it was almost, even though the South was defeated, it was the slave owners' version of the Civil War. And that only really changed with the rise of the teachers' union led by leftists in the 1930s, who insisted that the truth about the Civil War be told. But again, I want to make the point, because we're going back to a surge of public education activism and teacher activism. It was the left-wing progressive teachers and their organizations that basically started to insist that the Northern version, or the victor's version, the U.S. version of the Civil War be taught. It's really something, and I think it has relevance for what's going on.
It absolutely does, I think, because what we see is that while the North putatively won the war, they lost the narrative. And the narrative was somehow the glorious South, the rebels. The reality is that the Confederacy was nothing more than a group of traitors who were willing to ruin the entire nation in defense of one single freedom, and that was the freedom to own other human beings. We have to face that, and we have to look at it. And you can't imagine, why are there Confederate symbols everywhere? Why are people like Robert E. Lee considered heroes when actually they were traitors? And it would be as if you go to Germany and there'd be Nazi insignias everywhere. And, you know, we have to understand that not only was it right to abolish slavery, but the afterlife of slavery lives on, and it too must be abolished. So I think that this is a huge project of public education. Interestingly, it's happening at the moment of Black Lives Matter. It's happening at the moment when Confederate statuary is going down. And now we're seeing the victims of that racial violence going up. I think that's a really significant turn, and one that we should not only embrace, but that we should rally to expose young people to.
There's a very important opportunity here to educate young people. There was a poll that was released just a couple of weeks ago saying that only 18% of high schoolers know what the Holocaust was. Now,
right.
I can't imagine that that number would be too much higher among high schoolers being asked what the Civil Rights Movement was. And it's because we don't really teach it. I mean, not like it should be taught anyway. And this is an opportunity to really expand that kind of education.
I think you're absolutely right. But I think, you know, not only do we live in the United States of amnesia,
right,
but it's a huge failure of our educational system that people don't know history, and that we don't understand history as a living, contested area that needs to be explored. And instead, we learn, you know, facts and testable, you know, figures. But that's not history. History is always both what happened and the story of what happened. So yes, slavery was officially ended, but we also got the 13th Amendment. Let's teach that. And let's see Ava DuVernay's brilliant film, 13th, which really exposes the way slavery lived on, even in the law, after its official abolition.
We have about, I guess we're out of time.
I thought I was going to ask. We are completely out of time.
We're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Bill Ayers. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. At least we have him again next week, so that's something to look forward to. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this short message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Admiral Harry Harris has been nominated to be Donald Trump's next ambassador to South Korea, an outrageous idea for a man who presided over the torture at the Guantanamo military base. We'll look into his record. We're joined from Seoul by Emmanuel Pastreich, founder and director of the Asia Institute, a pan-Asian think tank. Emmanuel, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We're happy to have you. Tell us, why in the world would the Trump administration appoint Harry Harris to be ambassador to South Korea? He doesn't have any South Korean or Korean experience, does he?
Well, it's very unusual to suddenly reassign an ambassador at the last minute, but I think we have to see it in context of the specifics of what Australia and South Korea have in common. They're both countries that the far right in the United States have been leaning on to adopt a very strong anti-China military policy, and both countries simply don't want to do it. They have too many ties to China. And so Harry Harris, or Dirty Harry, was assigned to Australia, which has been waffling and has a very strong opposition out there around the Trumbull government. And I think we can say pretty clearly he was sent to sit on them and make sure. I mean, first, assigning military officers as ambassadors is not unprecedented, but it certainly is a disturbing trend. And the sudden switch, I think, for most of us seems to derive from the buildup to the recent summit, the inter-Korean summit between Chairman Kim Jong-un and President Moon Jae-in, which was quite successful, went much further than I think anybody in Washington had imagined it might go, and probably set off alarm bells in certain heads that Korea was at risk of starting to make its own decisions and possibly moving away from this profoundly anti-China rhetoric, which has been at the core of the Trump administration's posture.
Emmanuel, this is Brian Becker here. Let's talk about the timing of Harry Harris's nomination, because it was widely expected that Victor Cha, an academic and former George W. Bush official, would be named to be that post. And at that time, Cha came out sort of warning against a preemptive strike, so-called preemptive strike, meaning a war of aggression against North Korea. And then he was dropped, and it seemed like the U.S. was, you know, steamrolling towards confrontation. But then suddenly, after the Moon Jae-in, Kim Jong-un communications and high-level talks between North and South Korea, not this weekend, but a few weeks ago, Donald Trump, at the urging of South Korean envoys, instantly said, yes, I'll meet Kim Jong-un. And a new momentum was developed in the direction of a possible peace deal. Is it possible that Harris was nominated or selected earlier, and then this whole process changed the complexion of where we're going? In other words, might it be not a threat or a danger or a warning to North Korea that Trump, in fact, is planning confrontation rather than the summit?
Well, I would tend to see the nomination not as a threat to North Korea at all. I think it would be perceived as a threat to China. And the whole unification, I think within the sort of the far right in the United States, there's sort of three scenarios for what they imagined for Korea's role. One is that Korea to the Chinese side. I think they've moved away from that scenario. The second is that South Korea and North Korea would unite and join with the United States, Japan, and Australia in a confrontation with China. And of course, the third would be maintaining what's been the case so far. But I think this second scenario, that the peninsula moves towards unification, but it goes over to the American-Japanese side for a confrontation with China, maybe one leading to military conflict, that this is the primary driving force or concept behind this.
And do you, Manuel, do you think that that's what his marching orders are going to be from the State Department? Mike Pompeo just last week became the Secretary of State. He's the former CIA
yes.
director. He's very
Correct.
Conservative. He was a member of the House Freedom Caucus,
right.
the far
right
wing caucus in the House of Representatives. Do you think that that's the policy? That's the plan, even if it hasn't been made public yet?
I hate to say that I think there is a policy. I think there are what we see is basically an interference pattern between different competing factions. And I think Harry Harris is, I think, representative of what you might, I think we tend to think of as a sort of warlord class, military officers who have their own base to support and pursue their own interests. I'm not so sure that he necessarily takes all his marching orders from the White House. I think he has his own, loyal followers and support. It was interesting that he was awarded the same week he was appointed as the ambassador to Korea, the Order of the Rising Sun in Japan, and met with Abe. This is just last week, which I must say doesn't look very good for an appointment to as ambassador to Korea, because the two countries have had such difficult relations. And I think in a previous age, which we can imagine even a couple of years ago, it would have been inconceivable to appoint someone with that close of ties to Japan as ambassador to Korea.
We're speaking with Dr. Emmanuel Pastreich. He's the director of the Asia Institute in Seoul, South Korea. Emmanuel, I can tell you from my time at the State Department, as short as it was, that in countries that are important, major countries important to U.S. policy, it's not unusual for the president to call the U.S. ambassador directly, to go around the Secretary of State. I saw it happen all the time. What advice do you think Harry Harris is going to give Donald Trump when that call takes place?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I could easily imagine that happening frequently because there's so much chaos in Washington, D.C. But I would guess Harry Harris has made his position adamantly clear, and that is that the major threat is China, that we have to prepare for conflict with China involving a lot of heavy machinery, weaponry. He's certainly been a major force behind the move away from sort of war and terror, future conflicts, and back to big armaments, tanks, ships, aircraft carriers. So my guess is he would be advising that we have to bring Korea over with Japan, and that we have to see China as a sort of imminent threat. And we have to move away from the previous strategy under Obama, which was hinting that China might be some possible untrustworthy player, but saying only North Korea is actually a threat, that not explicitly. And that's, we saw that with the whole THAAD anti-missile defense system, where it was clear to most, expert analysts that this system was not particularly meaningful in responding to any threat from North Korea, but it was quite significant in its ability to, through radar, to survey China.
Of course, as we're talking about, John, the Nuclear Posture Review, the National Security Strategy, both documents really reorient U.S. foreign policy and military policy in particular in the way that Emmanuel's talking about. It's not about ISIS and it's not about al-Qaeda. It's not about the war on terror. It's the U.S. through contingency planning, budgeting, prioritizing, preparation for major power confrontation. Emmanuel, this seems insane.
It is insane.
Yes, it is insane. It seems insane and it is insane. And yet it is the U.S. policy now. And it's not just Trump. Go ahead. 1 minute left.
Well, I think we're having serious institutional dysfunction and decay. And Harry Harris, I think, is representative of a new class of political generals. There used to be an old saying that for whatever they say, military officers don't really want war because they suffer. But political generals have a different, more cavalier attitude, and I think that makes it much more dangerous.
Yeah, and of course, they actually don't do any of the bleeding, do they?
Not political generals. I'm sure he would be out of there pretty quick.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Seoul, South Korea by Dr. Emmanuel Pastreich. He is the director of the Asia Institute in Seoul. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Our friend and frequent guest, Randy Credico, was invited to the White House Correspondents' Dinner over the weekend. He was a guest of Yahoo News, but the Washington swells didn't like Randy's message of freedom for Julian Assange, and they unceremoniously threw him out of the event. We're going
nice
to talk
going.
About it.
Nice going, Randy. Got thrown out.
Randy's joining us from New York. Randy, we got to hear the story.
I got to be honest. Go ahead.
I was just going to say all the wonderful things that you've done. You're a candidate for governor of New York right now. You're an activist, a comedian. You're a former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. So you've got the cred to be in this thing. What happened?
Well, listen, I have, as you know, been a subject of this whole Russiagate affair for the last 6 months, if not longer. And so, you know, Yahoo News, I've done their radio show, Skullduggery, and, you know, they just invited me because I'm involved in it, obviously, and I'm kind of a harmless guy. I'm a nonviolent, harmless guy, and I'm a comedian, too, so... I went, and I got to tell you something. The first 2 hours, I had a great time. I had too great a time. I was there rubbing elbows with everybody that normally are people that I would not hang out with. I'm talking about not the guys from Yahoo News. They're very nice to me. I wanted to criticize them. But you know, the CNN people, I was sitting with CNN talk. I went from one party to the next, all right? And it was open bar everywhere. It was open food, and everybody was there. And so... I was saying to myself, you know, it'd be very easy, this is very intoxicating, to kind of get co-opted. Seriously.
It's oh, yeah.
Like, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, I was hanging out with Brian Becker and Max Blumenthal and others of that ilk the night before, and that's my company, right? So the next day I'm on the side of the people that are with power, the power side, this guy, Ari Velci, whatever his name is. All these people, they knew me. They all knew me from this, and that's the reason why I was invited. But, you know, I'm floating around and talking to a lot of people. Nancy Pelosi I'm talking to about Assange inside this room. And then here comes Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff says, I do want to talk to you. I do want to have you come down. You're one of the people. And he says, I don't think we should get a picture taken together. So I took one like 10 feet away.
We saw
he
that.
Was very charming because he's like, he used to, you know, if I were still living in California, he'd be my representative. So we had a nice 10-minute chat probably about it and how he'd like me to come in. Then I talked to Trey Gowdy, like just 20 minutes later, who's on the Republican side. And he was like the most charming person I ever met, to be honest with you. It was like that Southern charm. Not the hardcore guy you always see, like, excoriating people during these committee meetings. So, and then, like many others that the people I knew forever, right? Jimmy Hoffa Jr., who I unfortunately didn't mention this, one of my credits, he comes up. I'm on talking to Jimmy Dore. He comes up and he says, I couldn't have won in 96 without Randy Credico. I ran this entire bogus campaign called Humor for Hoffa because the guy used to be with the Communist Party of America, Greg Tarpinian, who left it. And he was like the leftist guy. He says, you got to go with Hoffa because Ron Kerry is a Republican, blah, blah, blah. So I got sucked into it. And then, of course, I bolted from him. He wouldn't take a picture with me later on.
Oh, wait a second, Randy. I don't mean to interrupt, but just to ask you, you're talking about Trey Gowdy and Adam Schiff. These were the people who subpoenaed you before the House Intelligence Committee, and you took the Fifth Amendment. You wouldn't testify on the grounds that it might incriminate you. But you like them as people?
No, I'm saying they were, when you're in that situation, I'm trying to explain. I'm in a situation talking with them, and I'm not going to be bellicose because I didn't want to be.
Well, you're very polite. You're a polite person.
Right. I can mix with anybody.
You're well-mannered.
When I was in Nicaragua in the 80s, this is it. This embodies me. I said I supported both sides of the war in Nicaragua. And here's how. I supported the Sandinistas directly with money and benefits and all of that. I indirectly supported the Contras because I had an incredible cocaine habit at that time. And so that helped out the Contras. That was a joke of mine I used to tell. So now flash forward to yesterday. I'm able to mix. You got to be able to do that. I'm like this guy Mishkin in the Dostoevsky guy, right? So I can just I'll mix and try to find out the nice things. You know, I'm in disguise. I'm an infiltrator, basically.
Randy Credico is our guest, comedian, activist, nice guy. Randy Credico is with us. Okay, so you're there, you're mixing, you're rubbing shoulders, even with the people who are trying to, you know, subpoena you, who did subpoena you.
Right.
Then they threw you out. I saw pictures of you. You look great in a tux.
I do. I'm going to wear that in my casket. So, you know, I got to tell you something. I was with everybody. I can't enumerate all the people. So now after all of the parties are over, the pre-parties, the cocktail parties are over from 5:30 to 7:30, it shifts into the main ballroom there. And you get in there. I had a table like close to the front. And guess who's sitting next to me on my table is Jeff Weaver, who is the campaign manager for Bernie Sanders. And we talked about comic books. He has a comic book store. And so I knew about Superman and Flash and all these. So now I'm getting not bored with him because other people are talking to him. I said, I'm now feeling pretty. I was getting restless. So I started walking around just to see who was in there. I go to the table that's got the CNN table, that guy Manu Rahu, the guy who pronounced my name as if I was Raskolnikov or Rasputin. He called me Credico when my name was broke on CNN. That guy Manu Rahu called me Credico. So I went up to him, and the guy's laughing. He said, come on and sit down. So I'm sitting talking to him. Now I'm sitting at the CNN table. Next to me is Joe Jones or Johnson, the African-American reporter who's very, very nice guy, the guy with the shaved head that you see in the morning. And the other one is Zeleny or something like that. And then I got Chris Cillizes sitting to my right.
Oh, yeah.
He is
Washington Post.
What a creep. He was such a snake, because I was saying, look, I like the way you grit your teeth when you're talking, the way you put it together like Bogart, you know? And he did not like that, and he slipped away. And I found out about him from other reporters that nobody likes him in the mainstream media. Nobody likes Chris Cillizes. So he was very rude to me. But everybody else at that table, I'm seeing the people that are promoting Russiagate there at this big table, the blonde anchor. I'm sitting at their table and taking pictures. And then I said, man, this would be very easy to slip into this lifestyle. And I'm thinking of Julian Assange. These people are all partying it up. These people are all having a great time while this guy is suffering. The greatest journalist around these days is suffering. He's holed up like a Tower of London. He can't talk to anybody. He can't see his mother, his kids. And I'm thinking, look what everybody here is going through. And that guy, this heroic man, is sitting in that place in the embassy without anything, without being able to communicate. He's in isolation. I'm thinking, look at the dichotomy, right? These people, it's like the Academy Awards are, you know, celebrating each other as if all those films are good in Hollywood. They're celebrating each other. Rod Rosenstein is in there. They're all in there.
Good heavens.
I got up in the middle, and I started shouting to the stage in front of the CNN. I said, we should be supporting Julian Assange. We should be celebrating him. Long when I kept shouting, and I did it in two different spots. The next thing I knew, it was like Randall McMurphy and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They grabbed me, and they took me through a side door, and then they slid me down this hall, like, really hard. So I feigned a heart attack because I thought my arms were going to break off, right?
Wait, did they lobotomize you?
I thought they were going to, because they all had, like they were scary guys in white outfits, you know, that were pulling me. But they yanked me out of there. I mean, you got to understand that the cream of the crop of the establishment was inside this place. You got a guy talking at the loud, you know, shouting. Now, I'm sure that I did not ingratiate myself with my hosts there, but they knew that I'm a wild card. You dress up Diogenes up and all the things that I've done. You know that I'm a prankster, too.
And that's why they invited you, wasn't it? I mean, they invited you because of who you are. You're a character. You're
a
persona.
You're a character. But actually, you know, John, what Randy did is in fact, in all seriousness, because we're horsing around lighthearted.
Sure.
Randy is a comedian, also lighthearted. But what he did is serious.
Yes.
And it's seriously important.
It's a freedom of speech issue.
And also what's happening to Julian Assange is such a travesty. You have the United Nations insisting that Julian Assange is the victim of arbitrary detention, meaning he should be free. And yet
Right. Everything
is going in the opposite direction. And what Randy's doing, even though we're talking in a lighthearted way, is critically important because what Randy's doing is what everybody actually around the country and around the world who values WikiLeaks and values an institution, a media institution that provides truth, because that's what it does.
Right.
It provides the truth that's concealed. We should all be yelling out for Julian Assange.
Exactly the point there. They should have been, if they were true to their the most trusted name in news, they're getting the award, but they're suppressing the voice of Julian Assange, and they're going around promoting the narrative that he is some kind agent of the other side of Russia, whatever.
All phonies.
It's outrageous.
And John, Randy's completely right. And the other thing is, all of these media, they use WikiLeaks, but they don't stand up for WikiLeaks when WikiLeaks is being gone after by
the
government.
They do the same thing with Snowden.
They did. Unfortunately, I think we're out of time.
We're out of time. We were talking with Randy Credico. Randy joins us from New York. He's an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. And he's also a candidate for governor of New York. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. And now you can follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.